From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. We all know that Oregon is wildfire country, and many, many of our communities are at risk during our now regular hot and dry summers. But did you know that a community's wealth and social safety net also impacts its wildfire vulnerability? Today on the show, you'll hear from an OSU professor who's helped develop a tool that better predicts wildfire impacts, not just due to environmental vulnerability, but social vulnerability as well. Think of it as a measure not just how much forest fuel is near a community, but how a lack of financial resources impacts its ability to manage that fuel and put out fires when they combust. Then, in the second part of the show, we get a report on how damaging Oregon's factory farms are on the environment and the lax regulation around them. Thousands of people, hundreds of trucks, and dozens of planes and helicopters are often needed to battle our state's increasingly large wildfires. But today on the show, you'll learn about another firefighting tool developed at OSU that relies on data and modeling. Andy McAvoy, a research scientist at Oregon State University's College of Forestry. Andy, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you developed, or part of a team that developed, this new tool to ascertain fire risks for communities in the Northwest. How did you develop this new assessment tool?
This new tool, it's a wildfire risk assessment, and it really builds on a foundation of tools that we've been using in the region for a long time. So Oregon and Washington, the federal land management agencies, state agencies, and partners have all been collaborating since about 2016-17 to develop wildfire risk assessments and to use those risk assessments in really important decisions about where we invest our resources in the state, our firefighting resources, our fuel mitigation resources, and that kind of thing. So we've been using these risk assessments for a long time, and they account for the probability of fire occurring and the intensity at which fire occurs. And then really importantly, when we talk about communities, they account for where our, you know, where our development is and how that development might be impacted by fire. So all that's just kind of background to say that we've been using wildfire risk assessments to inform our decisions, our prioritizations, and that kind of thing for a long time. What makes this particular assessment that myself and colleagues just developed a little bit different is that we've incorporated social vulnerability or sociodemographic information into that assessment of, or that that evaluation of wildfire impacts. Okay. So we know, the research shows us for decades now, that there are various socioeconomic and demographic characteristics that inform how a community is impacted by natural hazards, including wildfire. And so this effort was really an attempt to improve our projection of potential wildfire impacts by incorporating those socioeconomic and demographic characteristics.
Okay, and pull that thread a little bit more. Help us define social vulnerability, you know, especially with regard to wildfire risk.
Social vulnerability, it's a term or a concept that has a long history in the public health world and natural hazards planning. It's relatively new to wildfire, largely because, you know, it's in response to these catastrophic community disasters we've seen, from the Camp Fire to Lahaina to LA and the Marshall Fire. So as we have more of these catastrophic events, it becomes glaringly obvious that some communities face more severe impacts than others, or some parts of communities. And so social vulnerability is a term that we use to describe the socioeconomic and demographic characteristics that inform a community's ability to prepare for and recover from wildfire. Yeah, so that's what social vulnerability is.
So if I'm hearing you right, it may not just be, oh, a community is surrounded by lots and lots and lots of fuel. This takes into account that a community might be surrounded by those fuels, but also doesn't have the resources to fight a fire. Is that a fairly general idea of what you're talking about?
I think that's a pretty good, that's a good first look at it. What I would add to that is it's not just about fighting fire. In some cases, that's absolutely true. We actually some colleagues published a paper about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, that demonstrated that in Central Oregon, communities experiencing higher degrees of social vulnerability are actually exposed to more large fires and escaped fires, indicating that they probably don't have the same kind of firefighting capacity or access to the same resources and technologies that better resourced communities do. So firefighting is definitely one place where those socioeconomic characteristics show up, but it's also in the preparation for fire, right? Communities with less social vulnerability, so more resources, arguably are better able to prepare for wildfire. And maybe that's because, you know, they have a more stable tax base that they can, from which they can draw the revenue to do the vegetation management or to, you know, cost share and invest in improving their infrastructure, or hardening their infrastructure. It could be that communities with more resources often either have more wildfire professionals on staff, or they can contract with wildfire professionals to advise in this work, to do this work. And a lot of this is, you know, a lot of these funds, communities access a lot of these resources through competitive processes. They have to make a case for themselves. They have to demonstrate that they are at risk. And that they have the capacity to use the funds to mitigate that risk. And, you know, there are some communities that are very professional in that approach and really able to advocate for themselves well. And other communities might not be able to do that. So the socioeconomic and the demographic characteristics show up in a lot of different ways.
Okay. I'm wondering about the fact that in reading a summary of the report, your tool, especially the way that you're looking at it, kind of opens up a lot more communities in the Northwest to what we would characterize as vulnerable for wildfire. Is that correct?
I think that's one way to interpret the results. I think it highlights, our results highlighted communities within these regions that we all think of as fire prone.
Okay.
You know, Southwest Oregon, Central Oregon, up through the gorge. These are places that, you know, we all know experience a lot of fire. And have been impacted in recent history by community wildfires. But within those areas, what our results really, what they do is they highlight communities that are experiencing both high hazard, so high likelihood of fire, but also are experiencing social vulnerability to a higher degree. And so, it does identify new communities that the state or others might prioritize for investments.
Okay. Are there particular communities that your tool is pointing and saying, this is a community under extreme risk, given both factors of wildfire potential as well as social vulnerability?
One of the things we did in our study was we used a hypothetical prioritization scheme. And so, you know, in the past, organizations like the Department of Forestry or the State Fire Marshal, they have, you know, say a pool of money from the legislature to invest in wildfire risk mitigation. They have to decide where to spend that money. And so in the past, they've developed sort of like a prioritization framework. Who's eligible for this money, kind of. So we used a prioritization framework like that. And when we do that, yes, there are certain communities that jump out, particularly when we account for social vulnerability. Some communities are at high risk and are a priority no matter what, regardless of what of their social vulnerability status. These are just, they face such extreme wildfire hazard that they are arguably a priority for investment. But there were some new communities. Let's see, some that come to mind would be Mosier up in the gorge. I don't think it's a surprise to anybody in particular that that stretch of the gorge there between Hood River and the Dalles is a fire prone place, but when we accounted for social vulnerability, we saw the community of Mosier move up about 40 some odd places in its statewide rankings. You know, if we were to rank all communities statewide, it moved up about 40 places. And then we have other communities like Riddle, which is in Douglas County, just and sort of at the edge of the valley and the Cascade Forests there. And similarly, when we accounted for social vulnerability, its relative ranking moved up about 54 places.
Okay.
So those are just two examples, but about 30% of the communities that we identified as priorities in this scheme were new priorities when we account, because we accounted for social vulnerability.
Okay. Let me reintroduce you to the audience. We're talking to Andy McAvoy. He is a research scientist at the Oregon State University College of Forestry. So I'm kind of wondering, are we looking at sort of... I hate to use this phraseology, it gets used so much, but a perfect storm of, you know, climate change exacerbating fire risk. And at the same time, we're seeing a lot less funding from the federal government. And I'm wondering if that also factors into this idea of social vulnerability too, just simply less resources coming from what used to be a very large pot of money, the federal government, that's being somewhat denuded. And of course, we're seeing, you know, rapid changes to fire vulnerability.
Oh, there's no doubt that this particular moment, this fire season and the next couple are going to be particularly challenging for those reasons, Michael. You're right that federal funding has really had a dramatic effect on our, particularly on the pre-fire side, the mitigation side. There are less resources available for states and then therefore for communities to conduct the kind of vegetation management, infrastructure hardening, those kinds of pre-fire preparations.
Okay.
And so that you're spot on about that. And in particular, everyone, I think, is so many people seem to be aware that this fire season were set up because of climate, you know, this year's super dry winter, we're set up for a really challenging fire season. And then you add on top of that, lots of changes and lots of uncertainty in the federal fire service. You know, the administration, as I understand it, claims that the fire service is at full capacity and functioning. You know, there have been no effects or cuts to active firefighters, but our experience and our insights tell us otherwise. And so I think we are set up for a very, very challenging year this year. And I think that will probably continue unless there's a change in, you know, budgets and that kind of thing.
Andy, my last question for you is sort of ultimately, what is your hope for the highest and best use of this tool and its impact on the Northwest?
I think the impact that I hope our tool will have is just a more refined and more accurate depiction of where of the expected fire impacts and where those occur. And hopefully that leads to a not only a more equitable distribution of fire-related and risk reduction resources, but ultimately a more effective distribution of those resources. My hope is that with this tool, we have a better picture of where we expect negative impacts from fire and that we can invest in that early and before those communities actually experience fire so they're prepared.
He's Andy McAvoy, research scientist at the Oregon State University College of Forestry. Andy, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us.
Thanks very much for the time. Appreciate it.
Now let's learn about the impacts of factory farming in Oregon and how regulation might be failing to curb the worst of it. Tara Heinsohn, legal director for the organization Food and Water Watch, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Why don't we start with this? Just tell our audience what Food and Water Watch is and what you do.
Food and Water Watch is a national environmental nonprofit. We work for safe food, clean water, and a livable climate for all. And we do that by combining grassroots organizing on the ground in states, including Oregon, as well as communications, hard-hitting research, and litigation.
Okay. In general terms, from your organization's point of view, talk about the impacts that factory farms have on the environment, be it local or statewide or national.
Factory farms are industrial livestock operations that generate enormous quantities of waste, and that waste impacts communities and the environment in a host of negative ways. So these facilities, they produce waste containing nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus that, when they run off into waterways, can cause things like harmful algal blooms and disrupt ecosystems. Nitrates also are a cause of certain cancers, and when this waste leaches into groundwater in communities dependent on it for drinking water, that can cause serious health problems, as we've seen with the nitrate contamination crisis in the lower Umatilla Basin in Oregon.
Okay. And that obviously nitrate comes from animals and their waste, and that's kind of where it sort of starts from.
That's right. And this waste isn't just manure. These are industrial operations that feed animals pharmaceuticals, sometimes heavy metals, and other things that end up in the waste stream that can have serious harmful impacts on the environment. This industry is also a significant driver of climate change, and it emits noxious air pollution that causes health issues and nuisances in rural communities.
Okay. And the Umatilla Basin, is that sort of ground zero for the problem here in our state of Oregon?
It's certainly one of them. It's the starkest example of environmental justice impacts from some of the biggest factory farms, not just in Oregon, but in the country. And specifically, I'm talking about Tillamook's Three Mile Canyon Farms, which houses some 70,000 cows and produces enormous quantities of waste. And state regulators have in the past found that they think that Three Mile's waste disposal in particular is contributing to the nitrate groundwater crisis in that region.
Okay. Your organization recently put out a statement, I believe it was titled, Oregon's Factory Farm Permit Falls Short. Talk about that permit and talk about what your organization sees as problems with it.
Sure. So the main way that factory farm water pollution is regulated is under permits, either under state law or under a federal law known as the Clean Water Act. So the permit that Oregon regulators just reissued was a Clean Water Act permit for facilities that can discharge pollution into the state's waterways. We're concerned about this permit for a number of reasons. First of all, we've been waiting for this permit renewal for almost 5 years. This permit has been expired since 2021, and the state has dragged its feet on renewing it. So we thought that after such a long delay, hopefully the state would make some meaningful improvements and ensure that this permit, which applies to hundreds of facilities across the state, would better protect our waterways and public health from the pollution risks of this industry.
Okay.
But essentially the permit was more of the same. It was very similar to the permit that had been on the books for the last 10 years, and we think it falls short.
Okay. What would you like to see the state of Oregon do?
One of the big deficiencies in this permit, and it's something we've seen in many states, is that the permit doesn't require these facilities to effectively monitor their own pollution. And that's really a cornerstone of how the Clean Water Act regulates dischargers. It imposes limits on the pollution you're allowed to discharge into waterways, and you have to actually monitor your pollution to make sure that you're complying with what the permit tells you you have to do. Now, this industry, generally speaking, just has to follow a series of best practices, and then regulators will kind of assume that they're not causing pollution. And that doesn't allow us to identify illegal discharges or hold back bad actors accountable. So we were really hoping that the state would impose meaningful pollution monitoring requirements in this permit, particularly because Food and Water Watch recently won a federal court precedent confirming that this industry is not exempt from those Clean Water Act monitoring requirements. They do apply to every industry. So here we think the state has ignored federal law and moved forward with a permit that really doesn't provide adequate accountability or transparency.
Okay. Is there a particular type of factory farm that is worse than others? I'm wondering, are cattle factory farms worse than, say, chicken or pig? I just don't know myself.
I wouldn't say worse necessarily. Different types of operations can cause more or less of different impacts of concern. So, for example, broiler chicken facilities are known for emitting really large amounts of ammonia air pollution, and that's really problematic to health for nearby communities. Dairies, which are very prevalent in Oregon, tend to manage their waste in a liquid form as opposed to a dry form, which makes it harder to manage responsibly. And it makes it a greater risk to running off into surface waters and leaching into people's drinking water. So in Oregon, dairies and huge facilities that we often call mega dairies are a significant concern.
Okay. A lot has been made about federal cuts to various oversight organizations. And certainly, you know, the Clean Water Act is a federal act. I wanted to hear from you what concerns your organization has with regard to what we're seeing at the federal level with regard to oversight, regulation, permitting, that sort of a thing.
It's hard to overstate our concerns. You know, EPA, like other agencies, have really been gutted by budget cuts and attacks by DOGE and otherwise. EPA has adopted some policy positions that put enforcement on the back burner, and that's going to mean it's all the more important for state regulators who are often kind of delegated responsibility for these programs to do their job, to issue strong permits, to make sure they're enforcing them, because we know the Trump EPA is not going to do that.
Okay. Do you believe factory farming can be made more environmentally safe and more health conscious for the environment it exists in?
Fundamentally, I don't think that it can ever be regulated enough that it won't have harmful impacts. And ultimately, Food and Water Watch and many allies are campaigning for a ban on factory farms. And we have worked towards a moratorium here in Oregon because we need a food system that isn't built around consolidated corporate power or around, inhumane and unsustainable practices to produce more meat for less money. We need to focus on a more sustainable food system that puts consumers and family farmers and the environment first. And that will require a just transition away from this extractive industrial model of livestock production. And we think with the right incentives in place and strong policies, we can get there. It's a long-term fight, but ultimately, just regulating pollution isn't enough.
Okay. Is it possible to feed our nation without factory farming? Can it be done? I know some people on the other side would say you can never scale up to meet the demand of American consumers. What do you say to that?
The idea that industrial agriculture is feeding the world and is necessary to feed the world is a talking point that we've been hearing for decades, and it's absolutely false. It is possible to realize a more just and sustainable food system that feeds everyone and feeds everyone healthier food. And there are so many ways that we can reform our food system by increasing regional food access, by reducing food waste. So I reject that entirely, and I think, a healthier, more sustainable diet is entirely possible.
She's Tara Heinsohn, Legal Director for the organization Food and Water Watch. Tara, thank you so much for coming on and chatting with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, you'll meet the young editor-in-chief of the Daily Emerald, the news organization that's affiliated with the U of O, but also sometimes a fiercely independent critic. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.